In 2006, then-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed California's Million Solar Roofs Initiative. The goal? Well, it was right in the name. 1 million rooftop solar energy systems across the Golden State.
The million solar roofs will provide 3,000 megawatts, which is an equivalent of powering 1 million homes. And it is clean energy, which means there will be a reduction of greenhouse gas that will be going to the atmosphere by 3 million tons. 3 million tons. This is an equivalent of taking 1 million cars off the road.
California's Public Utilities Commission was a key player in the effort, offering homeowners with rooftop solar attractive incentives, such as credits for electricity they generated but did not use. And it worked. Solar installations took off. And by 2019, California reached its mark.
When we first passed it, I didn't know how big 1 million was. And we kept thinking, that's a lot. We'll never reach that goal. But we reached it today, and a lot of people get the credit, but it was your determination and your force of will that got this bill through the legislative process onto your desk, and you're the one who signed it.
That's Dan Jacobson at Environment California, a nonprofit that lobbies for environmental legislation in the state. Now, at about 1.3 million rooftop solar installations, California is home to about 40% of the nation's residential solar energy capacity, generating about 10,000 megawatts of electricity, enough to power 3 million homes. Well, all that could come to a sudden stop. Because last December, the California Public Utilities Commission proposed significant cuts to rooftop solar subsidies. They say solar has actually increased rates for low-income residents still using conventionally generated electricity. The state's utilities and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers are lobbying hard for the change. On the other side, rooftop solar companies, homeowners, and environmental activists warn that cutting subsidies amounts to a solar tax that could prevent California from reaching another state goal, 100% clean energy by 2045. Well, asked last month what he thought, Governor Gavin Newsom said,
"Do I think that changes need to be made? Yes, I do."
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today on Point, California is giving us a glimpse of what happens when a program to expand renewable energy sources becomes a victim of its own success. And the deeper question it reveals is this: if states want to expand clean energy and protect low-income households from rate increases, maybe the problem isn't solar per se, but the entire structure of electricity markets. So, can and should improvements be made there? Well, we'll start today with Terry Tamminen. He's former secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency, and he served in that position under Governor Schwarzenegger when the Million Solar Roofs Initiative was first launched. Terry Tamminen, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for the invitation.
So, take us back to 2006. What was the genesis of this idea to put 1 million rooftop solar panels across California?
Well, when Governor Schwarzenegger ran for the office in 2003 in the rather unique recall election, I helped him write an environmental action plan, which included getting much more solar and other renewable energy onto the grid as soon as possible to tackle climate change and air pollution. And when we got into office, we started talking about what that should look like. How big could it be? We conferred with people like Dan Jacobson, who was in your introduction, and others around the state. And we came back to the governor with a plan, and he looked at it, and he said, "That's it? This is the fifth largest economy in the world, and that's all you're thinking?" He said, "We should have 1 million roofs covered in solar all over the state."
How many had you originally proposed?
Well, we hadn't actually talked about numbers of roofs.
Okay.
It was more kilowatts and kind of technical wonky talk. and so he said, "We can do better." So we went back to work. And as Dan Jacobson said in your introduction, we set a big goal. My team at the California EPA, actually it was Drew Bowen, who today is the executive director of the California Energy Commission. It was his brainchild, and he put the numbers together, and he said, "We can do 1 million roofs." And, you know, also in your introduction, you heard the governor say that the goal was to get 3,000 megawatts in total from all these roofs. Mm. Well, in 2019, he and Governor Brown and I celebrated the 10th anniversary of the program. We had not only achieved 1 million roofs, but those 1 million roofs generate 8,000 megawatts. Hmm. So more than twice what the original goal was, meaning the program is wildly successful.
Well, so and also if we remind ourselves back in 2006, I mean, the price of solar rooftop solar panels was what, significantly higher than it is now. So you had to find a way to make this an attractive deal for homeowners, right?
Well, that's right. And we studied different methods from around the world where they had incentivized solar. In Germany, they have what's called a feed-in tariff. They basically say, if you put solar on your roof at your own expense, we'll give you what at the time was about 50 cents a kilowatt hour. And typically people across the United States pay anywhere from 7 to 15 cents a kilowatt hour for their electricity. Here in California, it's higher, even up to 20 cents and more for, you know, if you use too much in a given month, et cetera. But imagine that, 50 euro cents per kilowatt hour, so a very high price, in order to incentivize people to do it. And so, like, even farmers started paving over fields because they got into the solar business. Others used an incentive model where the government would pay people an incentive to bring down the cost of solar to incentivize them to do that. And that's the model we chose. And we decided to front load those incentives. So, in other words, in the first year of the program, half of the cost of installing solar was paid by the state. If you waited a year, only 40%. If you waited another year, only 30%. And the idea was that by incentivizing a lot of it quickly, more companies would get into the business and bring the price down. And that's exactly what happened.
Okay. So then tell me the role that the Public Utilities Commission and the utilities themselves played at the start of the Million Rooftops Initiative.
Well, in the beginning, it was purely telling people, look, you can save money on electricity over time. You'll pay something, of course, to put the panels on your roof, but then they'll start generating some of your power, and you'll save money, and at some point you'll have free energy when you've paid off your solar panels. And so there's a thing that everyone pays on their electric bill called the public goods charge. And that's been used over time for things like buying old refrigerators and scrapping them so that people buy newer, more energy efficient ones, or various other programs designed at getting people to use energy efficiently or to adopt things like solar. So the idea was to take that public goods charge, which, by the way, on your electric bill, it's, you know, maybe a dollar a month or less for a typical residential consumer and a few dollars for businesses, but it adds up to quite a bit of money. And so the idea was to use that public goods charge to provide these incentives to people that that they would then put solar on their rooftop. The utilities weren't really happy about it because it is a technical challenge to have people generating their own electricity from the roof, sending it to the grid, and then using grid power at night or other times when there's not enough electricity coming from their roof. So that is a challenge, and that was one reason that they were afraid of it. The other reason was they didn't want to see a lot of people suddenly essentially getting off the grid and leaving stranded assets that they had invested in transmission and generation and so forth. So they fought to keep a limit on how much rooftop solar could be generated.
Tell me more about that, though.
Well, and so the utilities initially fought to get a 5% cap, where, in other words, that there would not be more than 5% of the energy generated in their region coming from rooftop solar. And then when we hit that, it was raised to 10%. And over time, it turned out that it really wasn't that difficult for them to take the solar from people's roofs and then allow them access to the grid at other times, or as is now called, net metering.
Okay. So here we are, a very successful, by all measures, as far as I can tell, plan to get more clean energy from rooftop solar into California and onto California roofs. So is the initiative a victim of its own success? Has the time come to an end to essentially subsidize rooftop solar in California?
You know, I think economists have to kind of debate whether or not it would stall out if there weren't incentives, and the incentives are certainly a lot less today than they were before because, as you pointed out, thanks to front-loading the incentives and so many people putting solar on their rooftops, that did lead to competition that led to a reduction of almost 70% of the installed cost of solar on a rooftop from when we started this program. And that does suggest that then you don't need the subsidies or as much subsidies and people will do it. But you shouldn't then penalize people for putting solar on their rooftop by starting to charge them more just to have access to the grid or some of the other things that are in the legislation that is pending. We want to continue to make sure that we get more solar on rooftops because we're running out of time. Climate change has proven to us that we just don't have another moment to spare, and we've got to make this transition to clean energy as quickly as we can. And here in California, one of our two nuclear power plants closed because it was leaking and couldn't be fixed. And the second one, Diablo Canyon, is about to be closed out of safety concerns. And so when you lose what was 20% of the state's energy, you've got to replace that with something. And that's both energy efficiency measures, like I mentioned, how the public goods charge is used to incentivize people to buy more efficient appliances and things like that. But it's also things like getting more solar on rooftops, getting everybody involved in generating clean energy and enough energy for the state to avoid blackouts.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk after we come back from the break about the specific changes that are being proposed and that the California Public Utilities Commission eventually will have to vote on. So, Terry Tamman, stand by for a second. We are talking about what's being called the battle for rooftop solar in California, but the bigger lessons that the entire nation can take from efforts to expand clean energy sources in a state and what that tells us more deeply about electricity markets in general. So we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the battle in California over rooftop solar there and what proposed changes to incentives for homeowners to put solar panels on their roofs, what those proposed changes tell us more deeply about how we transition to a cleaner energy economy, the roadblocks along the way, and whether the bigger question is, should we change electricity markets as a whole? I'm joined today by Terry Tamman. He's former secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency, one of the architects of the state's Million Solar Roofs Initiative. He's now president and CEO of AltaC. Now, one of the changes that's being proposed by the California Public Utilities Commission has to do with adding what they're calling a grid participation charge for homeowners or businesses that have rooftop solar. So that would be an additional $57 per month added to the bill for solar users. Now, critics, including former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, basically call this a solar tax. Well, we reached out to one Californian who put solar on his roof, Raj Pandey. He lives in Irvine, California. And 4 years ago, he installed solar panels and a battery to store the electricity at his home. And he said he had a long time considering it. He wanted a system that would more easily support the electric vehicle that he replaced his 20-year-old car with. And by the way, he owns a Tesla Model 3 now. But he also wanted rooftop solar because,
being in California, there can be times where the power is not reliable, especially in summer. You know, you either have flex alerts where the company's asking you to voluntarily turn up your thermostat to 78, or you can actually have rolling blackouts. And neither of those, you know, none of those prospects are attractive. So to gain some independence from that, I really was very interested in solar and battery.
Pandey paid $26,800 to install the solar panels and batteries in his home. Now, the state's subsidies dropped that cost ultimately to $18,000. Now, when he heard about the Public Utilities Commission proposal, the proposal to add grid participation fees, he was shocked.
You're getting penalized for putting something in that's helping relieve stress on the grid. You know, and becoming more energy independent, where you're providing clean energy to your neighbors. And so I think when you look at all that, getting charged an extra $57 a month, that seems drastic.
Pandey also says that on top of penalizing current solar users, the fees could discourage residents who have been seriously considering adding solar, like his neighbor.
It's always kind of a borderline thing with him where, yeah, you know, I might get solar. If we get summers that are consistently hotter or whatever reason, the rates go up for electricity, then he would certainly be more on the side of, yeah, let's go ahead and get the panels. But if he's going to have to pay $57 extra per month, plus there's going to be a drop in the value of what he's pushing out, then he's completely off the fence at that point. He's like, I might as well just stick with what I have.
That's Raj Pandey. He lives in Irvine, California, and has had rooftop solar on his house since 2018. Well, let's bring Matt Friedman into the conversation. He is staff attorney at the Utility Reform Network, specializing in electricity. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hello, Meghna. Great to be here.
Okay, so first of all, the Utility Reform Network. I was looking into the history of TURN, as it's known, and I think it started originally as an organization to push back against the Public Utilities Commission. Is that right?
That is what we do every single day of the week. We are a nonprofit ratepayer advocacy organization fighting for the interests of all residential customers of utility services in California. And so every day, our attorneys and experts are at the PUC and at other state agencies fighting to lower rates for all customers and to hold the utilities accountable for their actions.
Okay. So what is TURN's overall take on proposing any changes or any cuts to state supports for homeowners who want to add solar panels to their homes?
Well, our view is that the net metering program in California has been very important. It has moved the solar industry from a bunch of hobbyists to a global industry, and it supported the deployment of rooftop solar when costs were sky high and electricity rates were a fraction of today's levels. You talked about the Million Solar Roofs initiative. Rooftop solar costs have dropped by more than two-thirds since that initiative was launched. But retail rates, which have been used as the metric for compensating these solar systems, have more than doubled for some utilities in California over the same time period. So today we're providing much greater subsidies for rooftop solar than ever before, even though the costs of solar itself have plummeted. And the problem is that the costs of the program are recovered in the rates of all electricity customers. They're not borne by the utilities, and they're not the responsibility of the shareholders, which we would love to see happen, by the way, but that's not how it works. And as a result, the program has now become a major contributor to higher overall rates. And higher rates are creating a crisis of affordability in California for working and low-income families. So our view is that the existing program is just not scalable to accommodate significant increases in rooftop solar. Today, 90% of residential customers don't have rooftop solar, and 95% of low-income customers don't have solar. So we need to figure out how to reform the current system going forward so that the rest of customers are going to be able to benefit from this program, and that we're going to be able to see an affordable way forward to meet California's really ambitious decarbonization and clean energy goals. We're committed to going all the way on clean energy in California. The question is, what's the best strategy for getting there, not whether we should or shouldn't rely on solar power?
Exactly. So this is why I'm so delighted that both of you can join us for this conversation. But first, let me just turn back to Terry Tamman in here for a second. The concerns Matt laid out, Terry, while also supporting the idea of transitioning to a clean energy future, that core concern about equity is also what the utilities are advancing. They're basically saying that solar is, you know, making it too expensive for other ratepayers, and so therefore, time to stop subsidizing solar. What's your first response to that, Terry?
Well, my first response is TURN does great work in protecting consumers, and thanks to Matt and his colleagues. And Matt, it's great to hear your voice again. But I would say that, look, you have a lot of things that we pay for in common. I don't have kids in school, and yet I'm happy to pay my taxes for schools, police, fire. I've never had a fire in my home, but I'm sure glad that I pay for that. And there are ways to subsidize the electric bills for low-income citizens, which already exist. There are ways to help relieve their energy bills, regardless of why those bills are higher, whether it's because of solar or anything else. And I think in a state where last year we had a $70 billion surplus, this year it's likely to be $30 billion. We're certainly the fifth largest economy on the planet, one of the richest economies in the history of the planet. There are many ways to help those who need the assistance without killing the golden goose here that is going to deliver us a future. I mean, you mentioned in your introduction that this is a battle for solar. It isn't. It's a battle for a sustainable future. We've run out of time to sort of nibble at the edges of these things and experiment. And Matt said it best, 90% of homeowners don't yet have solar. Mm-hmm. So even though we've achieved 1 million roofs and 8,000 megawatts and brought the cost down by 2/3, as he said, and so forth, we have a long way to go to achieve energy independence. But also, as your other guest said a little bit earlier, to make sure that we're more resilient, that when we have these climate-induced wildfires, these enormous winds that they create all the way to the Bay Area and other places where even the wildfires don't hit directly, all these other climate change-induced issues, that we have ways of continuing to power our homes and businesses.
Yeah. So, you know, what's the entity in the middle of all this are the utilities, of course, right? And they're not featured, that we don't have their voices on this program today. But we also, I should say, we reached out to the Public Utilities Commission as well. No one from the commission could join us. But Matt, give us a sense about, are the utilities, in the electric utilities in California, are they mostly investor-owned?
About 2/3 of the power that's sold in California are sold under investor-owned utilities. And we also have, though, various forms of competition at the retail level in California. We have community providers that are also serving customers across the state. We have some competitive retail providers that are private companies. And then we have a big chunk of utilities in California that are publicly owned nonprofit municipal utilities. Okay. And I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of these municipal utilities in California have undertaken significant reforms to their net energy metering programs because they've been concerned also about the impact of the existing programs on all customers. And they've been aware that there are many cheaper alternatives in the form of buying bulk renewable power on the wholesale market to meet California's ambitious goals. So it's really been about least cost strategies to achieve decarbonization, not whether or not California is committed to the goals at all.
Yeah, no, point well taken here. But we've got this interesting comment from a listener, Christopher, on Facebook. I think he gets right to the heart of the matter. He's in Louisiana, and he says, in Louisiana, we've seen utility companies move the goalposts by claiming solar costs other customers more money, like exactly what we're talking about in California. But Christopher says, if we're being honest, the utilities would say solar panels are costing utility company profits, and their solution is to raise prices and blame solar owners. It's like your local grocery store saying, sorry, folks, we have to charge you more for tomatoes because more people have started growing them at home. So, Matt, respond to that.
Yeah, well, you know, that might be true in Louisiana, but it's not true in California. The utilities aren't taking a hit to their bottom line as a result of the rooftop solar program. You know, in California, we have some different features of our political landscape and the way we regulate utilities compared to what we're seeing in other parts of the country. Over 20 years ago, California adopted rules to ensure that utility profits are not tied to the amount of retail sales on their system. And this was proposed by a lot of environmental groups to prevent utilities from trying to undermine energy efficiency programs and to stop them from earning excessive profits by promoting more electricity use. In other states, utility profits are often tied to retail sales, which means that rooftop solar does hit their bottom line. But in California, when a customer puts rooftop solar on their property, and the utility ends up paying them significant subsidies for that solar output that are way in excess of what they would pay on the wholesale market for solar, those costs are simply recovered from all other customers. The utilities get approval to recover costs for maintaining the grid, and those costs are going to be recovered regardless of whether customers put rooftop solar on. So that's the problem that we're facing in California, is how do we balance the interests of customers that put rooftop solar on their homes with all the other customers that have to pay the bill? And is the current system really providing the right level of subsidy to the right customers? Currently, we provide higher subsidies to rich people than to poor people because of the way that we structure it. I don't think that makes any sense. We think that subsidies should really be targeted to low-income customers rather than high-income customers.
Okay, so now I'm getting a better understanding of sort of how the market works in California. Terry Tamminen, let me turn back to you on this. It's still a matter of the utilities wanting to recover their costs. Because, look, in my very simple analysis, that's because it does ultimately have an impact on their profits if they cannot recover costs due to these subsidies. So is there a better way, Terry, to eliminate that problem? Should the subsidies be coming or the cost incentives be coming from somewhere else? And where would that be?
Well, a couple of thoughts. First of all, Matt's absolutely right that the utilities themselves are guaranteed their profits because they're regulated monopolies. And so they're assured that they're going to get their costs back one way or the other. He's also right that we need to fix this situation. I mean, it's kind of grown organically with fits and starts since the Million Solar Roofs Initiative, and it's definitely time for a tune-up. But I would say that, first of all, we are already paying, those of us that have solar, and I do, that we're already paying for this. So, for example, when I get my energy bill, I'm paying the grid for electricity at anywhere from 15 to 27 cents a kilowatt hour, depending on how much I use. But the solar power that I generate, I only get paid about 7 cents a kilowatt hour. Now, if the utility had to go out and procure power from a gas power plant or even from large-scale utility solar built in the desert, they'd be paying, you know, at least 12 to 15 cents a kilowatt hour. So there's about a 8 cents differential there. I'm already being underpaid that the utility is essentially getting in their pocket to be able to cover other kinds of costs. And he makes another point, Matt makes another point, that yes, it is cheaper for the utilities and easier for them to work with bulk providers like somebody who builds a solar farm out in the desert. But that's also where environmentalists have had lots of battles. I mean, remember when Dianne Feinstein proposed the Mojave Desert Protection Act, and one of the things that we were doing was putting solar in the desert, which some environmentalists wanted, but then those who were trying to protect the desert tortoise and other species said, well, you can't cover the desert with solar. So here we have all of these rooftops that in, you know, everything from homes to small businesses that we can use, and we also then get more distributed energy where it's needed.
So The distributed part I want to come back to in depth in a few minutes, but forgive me. Usually I have a better sense as to how these systems work, but I'm going to tell you I'm a little confused here because I heard Matt clearly say, and both of you clearly say, that utility company profits are not tied to retail sales. So, and you said, both of you said, it's heavily regulated here. But so then why are the utilities saying, well, we have to raise rates on other users because of solar. I just don't get it. There's something I'm missing here, Terry.
Well, and Matt can tell you this even better than I can, because I think he tracks the Public Utilities Commission much more closely. But remember that while the Public Utilities Commission essentially guarantees a certain level of profit for utilities, you have to make a rate case. You, the utility, have to go in and say, look, I've done everything I can in the public interest and to keep my costs down and so on and so forth. Therefore, I want either this higher tariff or I want this cost recovery mechanism to put fees on people's bills. And the Utilities Commission can say no, or they can say, yes, all right, you've made your case, but only half of what you asked for you're going to get. And then, again, I think there is this point where the utilities just don't want the complexity of net metering. I think they'd really like to get out of the business altogether.
Well, Terry, hang on here for a second. And Matt, I want to hear you on this question, too. But we'll wait till the other side of this quick break. So we're talking about rooftop solar and the fight for a clean energy future, as Terry Tamminen is putting it, in California, and the lessons for the rest of the country. So we'll be back in a second. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a quick heads up about what we're doing on tomorrow's show. Calling all Wordle lovers, all the many millions of you, we're going to be talking about why this sensational little game has charmed and captured the imaginations of so many people. What works about Wordle? Why do you love it? Why do we love it? We'll also be hearing from the New York Times about what they plan to do with Wordle now that they own the game. Paywall, anybody? So we're going to talk to the Times about that. But if you're a Wordle player, we want to hear from you. What do you love about it? What keeps you coming back every single day? Were you happy that the New York Times bought Wordle? Are you a little concerned about it? So just fandom, Wordle fandom. Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about what the state of California has to tell us about the future of clean energy, and specifically through the story of the current fight that's going on regarding subsidies or incentives for rooftop solar in California. And I'm joined today by Terry Tamminen. He's the former secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency, one of the architects of the state's Million Solar Roofs Initiative. He's now president and CEO of AltaC. And Matt Friedman joins us as well. He's staff attorney at the Utility Reform Network, specializing in electricity. And Matt, I'd want to hear from you. That's kind of very basic question I asked. Why I couldn't figure out why the utilities say they have to raise rates on other users because of the solar incentives. It just a simpler explanation will help move us forward here, Matt.
Sure. Well, I think it's consistent with what Terry said a few minutes ago, which is that utilities get approval to recover costs in rates. We fight them. My organization spends our days fighting the reasonableness of these requests that are submitted by the utilities. But once the utility gets approval to recover a certain amount of costs in rates, let's just call it $1 billion, for example, that $1 billion is going to be recovered through the bills paid by all customers. And to the extent that the utilities come up short in a given year, say they only collect $900 million because customers use less electricity than anticipated, that $100 million doesn't get eaten by the utility and its shareholders. That shortfall simply gets rolled over to the next year and added to the rates collected from all customers in the following year. So the utilities are relatively protected from fluctuations in sales. And once they get approval to recover costs, those costs simply get recovered in rates. And when one customer doesn't pay that cost, all the other customers end up picking up their share.
Okay.
That's pretty much how it works.
Got it. So first question then in terms of like what are improvements that can be made overall here. We've got a comment coming in saying, does anyone really think that PG&E will lower everyone's electricity bill if the California Public Utility Commission clobber rooftop solar? Matt, what do you think?
Well, that's what our mission is. We're focused on bringing down PG&E's rates. So PG&E makes proposals, but the Public Utilities Commission has the ability to approve overall rates. And so we wouldn't be taking this position in the current conversation unless we believed there was the opportunity for substantial savings by all customers. Mm. And let me put it into perspective. The current cost shift from the existing net metering program for all the current customers, so that's the amount that we're paying above what the solar, the value that that solar provides, is about $3.3 billion a year for the three big utilities. It ends up having a pretty material impact on rates for a PG&E customer. The typical impact is about $150 a year. For a San Diego customer, where their rates are much higher and solar penetration is at its peak, they're paying about $240 a year extra on their bills for the solar subsidy. And if we don't reform the program today and come up with a way to right-size the subsidy payments, those costs could double in the next decade.
Terry, do
and
you?
I mean, that's just a big problem.
Yeah, Terry, do you agree with that? I mean, that's a pretty strong argument for that. I mean, Matt's saying that, the state's overpaying for solar.
Well, look, I'm not going to argue the numbers with Matt because, again, he is an expert and really has done all the economics and the study. And, of course, so has the Public Utilities Commission. I'm sure that's some of the data he's relying on. So I'm not going to get into whether it's $200 on the bill of someone in San Diego or $50 on someone in San Francisco. But I would say that, you know, as he pointed out, 90% of the rooftops don't have solar. And so, you know, it seems unlikely that it's that significant when we're talking about only 10% that do. And there are a number of hidden costs that we're all paying. I mean, that's the point. Mm-hmm. I totally agree this needs reform. Let me state that again. Matt's absolutely right. The system needs reform, and nobody should be paying, you know, $200 more for energy that they're not using. But there's other ways for the state to make sure that that we continue to get the subsidies and we continue to generate solar power instead of turning on gas peaker plants when we have hot days, which are polluting everybody, when climate change continues to decimate this state with droughts, with wildfires, with more intense storms, with other things that are costing money. I mean, look at the wildfires that have wiped out entire communities. And that gets paid for by the utilities as well. I mean, there's lots of lawsuits and other ways to recover that. But basically, that's going to get dumped on the backs of ratepayers at some point as well. And they're making that case. Those utilities are trying to get ratepayers to pay for what amounts to their mistakes. So we can pay now or pay later.
Oh, I'm thinking about, I mean, look, we have a very not up to par grid here, you know, in California, because what was the campfire, right? It was caused by, in 2018, was caused by a failed transmission line, a PG&E line, right? And people died as a result of that fire. But there's, coming back to the equity argument that, in a sense, the utilities are making here, here's a simple question, Terry. I mean, if the utilities have to recoup the money somehow because they are guaranteed by the Public Utilities Commission a certain profit, should the Public Utilities Commission be guaranteeing profits anymore for the utilities? Is that a place that change could be made?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, yes, they have to continue serving that role because the whole point is if you're going to give a monopoly in an area to one of the three investor-owned utilities or some of the municipal-owned utilities in different places where, of course, profit is not the issue. There's only three investor-owned utilities, but as Matt said, they generate the majority of power in the state or distribute it. And so, you know, absent a market, you don't want them to just go crazy and charge whatever they want. So you do have to regulate what they can charge and how much they can throw on the backs of ratepayers In terms of cost recovery and so forth. But then it is only fair to say, okay, well, fair enough. We'll make sure at least that you're a thriving business and you don't go bankrupt and go out of business. I mean, it was only 20 years ago. And in fact, I probably wouldn't be talking to you today if we hadn't had the energy crisis in the early 2000s that led to the recall of Governor Davis and Governor Schwarzenegger's installation as governor and me being EPA secretary. And we might not be having this conversation. We might not have as much solar and be having this conversation if that hadn't happened.
You know, Governor Schwarzenegger wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times recently where he said PG&E and other utilities want us, being Californians, to rely on their grids. And this makes me wonder if really part of the challenge here and why people ought to pay attention to what's happening in California is that, you know, you mentioned the fact that the homeowners with solar now are essentially off the grid, right? I mean, it's a distributed power model, but that still ultimately, because they're feeding excess power back into the grid, it relies on a centralized grid system. So there's kind of a disconnect between how we maximize what solar can provide in terms of being that distributed model versus the infrastructure that we have today. Does that make sense, Terry?
Well, it does, but we're evolving. So yeah. We start by getting the solar on the rooftops and doing net metering because that's the practical way to do it, because obviously the sun doesn't shine 24 hours a day. So no matter how much you're generating, sun goes down. If you were off the grid, you would have no way to power your home. But then more and more people, as you heard the quote from an earlier guest you had there, are putting in batteries and having a way to store that energy. And at some point, that could mean they could be off the grid. But it also means that they are providing more resilience to a state that is suffering all of these climate change disasters and greater intensity wildfires and collapsing of the grid in various places. So as more and more people with solar think about then installing battery systems or may be incentivized to do so because even the utilities want to level out the demand. So they want to be able to have you store energy in your home or business and then call upon it during the peak demand times of hot summers and so forth. That is being experimented with as well by these utilities. So they're kind of a love-hate relationship with people that have solar and the utilities.
Matt, so then take us, do you have ideas on how to balance all these competing interests? Like how is there a system by which you can imagine that rates for ratepayers, especially those who are lower on the socioeconomic status, that they're not being disproportionately hit while also supporting the expansion of solar in California?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm very interested in seeing how we can think outside the box on this. And the most important idea that I'd like to put out today and that we've been socializing with decision makers in California is we need to find a way to remove a variety of costs from electricity rates and find other sources of funding to support some of these initiatives. Electricity rates are the most economically regressive way to collect costs from society. They hit lower-income and middle-income families the hardest. They hit families in the hot areas of the state even harder than families who live in the cooler coastal areas. So it's really not a great strategy for collecting billions and billions of dollars of subsidy payments. Instead, we'd like to look at opportunities to use tax revenues. The state's general fund, which, by the way, has a huge surplus this year, to provide funding for rebates to customers, or a state tax credit. A tax credit is basically as good as cash because it tends to come off the top of a customer's initial investment. So these sources of funding should be used to provide upfront subsidies. And that actually was our proposal in the current Public Utilities Commission process, was to, in a sense, replicate what the Million Solar Roofs Initiative did, which is providing upfront rebates to customers while at the same time reducing the compensation that they would receive through rates over 10 or 20 years. By reducing the compensation through rates, we protect customers that don't have solar, including low-income customers. And by providing subsidies from sources of money outside of rates, we're able to ensure that customers that do want solar are able to achieve whatever payback period is deemed appropriate to ensure that they're motivated to make these investments.
Yeah. Terry Tamminen, there's also something quite significant here that suddenly I'm wondering about. Because you talked earlier that an obstacle to the kinds of, potentially the kinds of meaningful changes that Matt's talking about and the expansion, further expansion of solar, is that the utilities, for example, I think you said they don't want stranded assets, right? Like just people not using utility assets as much anymore. But maybe that just has to happen. Because I'm thinking, I don't know if this is a great analogy or not, but in the advent of ride hailing, right, with Uber and Lyft, in a lot of cities, I happen to live in one in Boston, there was lots of pushback from extant taxi companies because they owned medallions, right? Like they had to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for those medallions. That was their asset for the right to be a taxi driver. And it suddenly became like basically worthless because people weren't using taxis as much. But
right.
Not an easy situation. People were hurt for sure, but like it was just one of the, it's just the rough interim period when societies, cultures, and technologies change. I mean, maybe that's what's going to happen to the utilities in California, too.
Well, it is. And I think that this is one of those things where, in fairness to the utilities, again, I totally understand they don't want to build transmission lines and try to modernize the grid. They're under a lot of pressure for that. Put some of their grid assets underground to avoid these problems that happen with wildfires and hurricane force winds and so forth. And invest in more generation or make commitments to those that do generate electricity, and then find that people aren't using that. They, you know, totally understand that if they're also a regulated entity, they're actually required to do some of that to make sure that the electricity can be provided, since there is no competition. So I totally understand that. But it is something where smart people and economists who can predict the future need to be planning for this transition, because it is going to happen. And I will say that, again, the utilities have had a bit of a break in that regard because, as we mentioned earlier, in the beginning of the program, they fought to make sure that not more than 5% of the total electricity in their area would come from rooftop solar, because they just didn't want to have too much complexity or too much of their assets be stranded all at once. And then slowly that has been increased over time. So they had their way. They've had a chance to go to the Utilities Commission and say, wait a minute, slow down, slow down. We've got to at least be able to understand this transition as it's happening. So I do think that there are ways to prepare for that. But Matt's absolutely right. There's lots of money in this state. You know, look, taxes are redistribution of wealth. Let's face it. The government takes money from us from different forms, whether it's on our utility bills or in our annual tax return. And they use that for services that we all agree that we need. And this is another one of those examples, but it's one that has perhaps gotten out of hand and, as Matt says, definitely needs reform so that it's fair, but so that it also accomplishes the goal. Let us not forget how urgent this matter is, that we have got to get off fossil fuels. We have got to have more distributed energy so that we are more resilient as a state to natural disasters. And we haven't even talked about earthquakes.
Mm. Well, Matt Friedman, we've got about 30 seconds left in the show. I want to give you the last word. Are you concerned that the current proposals, as put forth by the Public Utilities Commission, won't actually achieve any of the goals that you've talked about, and what it'll do is plummet the rate of new solar installations?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of details there we don't have time to get into. But as a general matter, we think that the proposal by the PUC goes in the right direction. We quibble with a bunch of the details, but we think it's really important to restructure the net metering program to protect the interests of all customers and to find ways to subsidize solar for participating customers through sources outside of utility rates. We're going all the way to decarbonization in the state, regardless of what happens with net metering. We're on our way to 100% zero carbon electricity.
Well, Matt Friedman, staff attorney at the Utility Reform Network, and Terry Tamminen, former secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency and president and CEO now of AltaC. Thank you both so much for joining us today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.